Hey everyone, this is Stacey Lindis from Podcast PD, a proud member of the Education Podcast Network, just like the show you're listening to right now. The opinions expressed are those of the individual host. Make sure you check out all of the other great podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com and get ready because the learning begins in 3, 2, 1.
Hey, today I'm talking with Ted Dintersmith. He's the author of What School Could Be, Insights and Inspiration from Teachers Across America. You're going to love this. He spent an entire year talking with teachers across the United States. Matter of fact, he went to over 200 schools. Not only that, he talked with all kinds of other people involved in talking about school and what happens there. And he was looking for innovation. He was looking for engagement, and he found it. Wait till you hear the message that he has to deliver. You're going to love this. It's going to set your brain on fire, and you're going to want to get ready to go back into class tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Enjoy. Hey, have you heard the new music for my show? It's called Microcosm, and it's written, produced, and played by Dr. Lodge McCammon. You can find out more at lodgemccammon.com. Thanks, Lodge.
You are listening to Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12, a podcast for educators, helping you help kids achieve their dreams. And now here's Steve with this week's show.
Ted Dintersmith is a successful venture capitalist with an eye on changing school. His four-decade career spans technology, business, public policy, and education philanthropy. He earned a PhD in engineering from Stanford University, led a high-tech startup, and ranked as the top venture capitalist in the U.S. for the years 95 through 1999. He is the co-author, along with Tony Wagner, of the book Most Likely to Succeed, Preparing Our Kids for the Innovation Era. Additionally, Ted was the executive producer of the documentary Most Likely to Succeed. Today, we are focused on Ted's book, What School Could Be, Insights and Inspiration from Teachers Across America. In this work, Ted chronicles his road trip to visit 200 schools across all 50 states during the 2015-2016 school year. He was intent on discovering inspiring educators. What School Could Be presents stories of teachers in ordinary circumstances doing extraordinary things. Please welcome Ted Dintersmith to the show. Say hi to everyone, Ted.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
Well, I appreciate you spending time with me. The book is great. It's neat hearing all these innovative voices from across the country. And what I'd like to do before we get to what school could be is you know, in 2015, you had success with talking about education in the movie Most Likely to Succeed and the book Most Likely to Succeed, Preparing Our Kids for the Innovation Era. Would you share a little bit about your message from Most Likely to Succeed?
First, I'd start with the fact that why did I start with the film? Because that was really the first contribution. And I feel like if you want to change people's thinking, logic really doesn't get you very far. And I felt like if we could somehow pull off a great film with emotional tie-in to what's going on with these students and their teachers, that might be more galvanizing. And so I did a search, found this really amazing director, Greg Whiteley. I would say anybody who loves the film, give him the credit. And if you've got any issues or complaints, blame me. But, you know, we just have had great experience with that film. We premiered at Sundance. We did, you know, 24 major film festivals. And what we wanted to do really is, and I think this is what he pulled off, is it's mostly a really compelling story. But if I just described in words, kids working on an interdisciplinary project in teams, most adults would hear that and say, that sounds like a great summer project or, you know, summer camp type of an experience or maybe a fun break from school. When you follow these kids and see what they're doing, you realize, oh my gosh, they are learning in the most profound and interesting way. But, and this is a big but, what Greg also did was he was able to connect that story and that experience to the bigger picture of what are the macro issues we should all be concerned about. And so there's a 10-minute clip there, segment in the film early on the history of education. People tell us all the time that's the best single treatment that explains, you know, 125 years of education in the context of how the world has changed, why things are so much more innovative. And so you see a story, you're really drawn into it, but you connect the dots to the bigger picture. And so that's what I think we accomplished with that film. I think what we didn't accomplish, and we go very directly at the point of don't copy the school. This is one school where they're doing what works for them. Don't copy it. And so people, I was hounded for, you know, after that film. Well, what should we do? What should we do? Which is what led me to take a long trip.
Gotcha. The you know, one of the things that you know, it is cool is that you end up visiting all across the country, and I can't wait till we get to talking about that. The you know, something I've got to say before we get in, move along further, is that what's refreshing is that this is not like an attack on teachers and an attack on you know, just public education has been under constant attack. There's been different movies and such that were like that. That's not what your movie Most Likely to Succeed is all about, is it?
No, not at all. No. And we show teachers trusted, and we show students having a voice in what they're doing. And actually, in the film, you watch two side-by-side ninth grade cohorts doing totally different things in the same roughly defined subject areas. And what we really are emphasizing is, look at what these teachers and students can do in an environment that trusts them and lets them learn what they're interested in instead of what some bureaucrat tells them they have to learn. And that difference is not 3% or, you know, 4%. You know, it's night and day.
So let's go to a TEDx talk that I watched you speak at a TEDx talk from a few years back, and I heard you say the following. You said, "Our country is the most innovative and determined on the face of the planet. Let's educate to our strengths instead of chasing Shanghai and South Korea." Could you explain your thoughts?
Yeah, and in the book, and I don't know if you remember this, but I highlight this really fascinating person named Doug Lyons, and he came up to me and said, February 6, 1992. And I kind of looked puzzled and I said, "Yeah." And he said, "February 6, 1992. And if he had looked like kind of a run of the mill guy, I would have ducked away and said, "I've got to go to the restroom," or, you know, "I need to somebody, you know, I got a phone call," or something. But he looked very dignified and he looked like he knew what he was talking about. And what he explained is that was the first day the New York Times ran a story after an international comparison of student performance on standardized tests. And the U.S. ranked pretty darn low across all the important categories. And it just sort of set in motion this feeding frenzy of, you know, we're America, we're uber competitive, we're not going to be second to anyone. And if these other places like Shanghai, like South Korea are clocking us in standardized test scores, darn it all, we'll close that gap. And it's just this groundhog day in education, right? We turn school into nonstop worksheets and test prep. Our kids are bored. They don't see its relevance. They don't do very well. The scores don't go up. So we say, let's do even more test prep and drilling. You know, let's go from, you know, No Child Left Behind to Race to the Top. And it's all around chasing this myth that the kids in Singapore and South Korea are learning more than we are. Yet they at the same time were saying, what can we do to get away from this rote drilling model? Because dang it all, the U.S. has all the innovation and all the creativity, and we need a lot more of that in our society. And so we're just chasing the wrong, you know, you're barking up the very wrong tree. And, you know, I'll tell you one other story just to, you know, and you can decide whether this is interesting or not. I find it interesting. I had dinner last month. Three people flew to meet me here from Beijing. And it's a long story, and it's a bit of like Ted screwed this up, but I had said to somebody there, you know, here's some DVDs. You know, they're really nice. They want to show the film to a few people in China. I said, here's some DVDs. You know, if you want to show it to a few schools, go for it. Well, they're doing, much to my surprise, online events around the film and routinely drawing audiences of 10 to 25,000 people to watch this film.
Wow.
The book I wrote with Tony has outsold in China in 4 months the number of copies we sold in the U.S. They said over 1 million people have watched Most Likely to Succeed. They will have my new book out 3 weeks after it's out in the U.S. And I finally broke down and said, okay, I'll go. So I'm going to be there in June, mostly just to see what it's like when a country takes this whole challenge of transforming its education system seriously.
That's awesome.
Well, it's awesome and frightening, isn't it?
Oh, yes. What I was going to ask you was, you know, what makes them focus on you? I mean, what do you think is the difference? why are they wanting to, you know, they can't wait for your book to come out so they can bring you back? I mean,
anybody I meet with in education overseas, I mean, Pasi Sahlberg's a good friend. He architected what's going on in Finland. Posse will tell you, hey, we get our best ideas from the U.S. You know, the difference is we do something about them and you guys think about them. You know, and so I think there's a fascination and an understanding that if there are some great ideas out there, they're likely to come from the United States. And I think that's why they're so interested in the new book, because I just show this mosaic of great innovation across classrooms in our country. As I said, what we tend to do is we just sort of moan and wail and say, gee, it's hard to change schools, or, you know, we gravitate toward these simplistic measures. And honestly, I feel like my counterparts, I mean, people with business backgrounds are some of the worst offenders. You know, people that made fortunes by being really innovative and creative that take policies and push data-driven, you know, curriculum on, down the throats of students and teachers. And I like to say, wait a minute, do you realize what you're doing? You're actually diminishing their creativity and innovation. And why would you ever in a million years do it? And I think it's just the sloppiness of casual thought. You know, it's just like, that's an easy number to latch onto. Let's value schools by test scores and college placements. All will be good if we get more kids, you know, through high school into four-year colleges. And I think it stands some risk of being, you know, the death knell of our society.
That's scary stuff, because that's where it's, you know, it's so stomps all over the idea of innovation, because you worry that if you do this, you know, if the scores don't go up, if, you know, other things don't work out right, that then you're gone or, you know, or the schools close down or whatever. And, but at the very least, you know, the staff is eliminated and, you know, let's switch to somebody else who can bring those scores up.
And it really gets to one of the points I took away from my trip, which wasn't even remotely apparent to me before, is I go to these quote unquote at-risk or underperforming schools with these, you know, academically ungifted students. And they say to me kind of in passing, or some are actually on this, like, you know, a dog on a pork chop, is, my gosh, you give these kids problems to work on that they care about and they think are important. And over these at-risk kids just come out of the woodwork and soar. And yet you give the same sort of messy, ambiguous real world challenges where you're going to fail multiple times. You give those to a, you know, a well-manicured kid in a rich school and neighborhood, and they like freeze up. It's like, oh my God, you know, like, tell me what to do. It's not clear what I need to do to get an A. And my takeaway from that is, I mean, I think we obsess around the achievement gap, but I think we've got achievement all wrong. And I think the gap we ignore, we want to gloss over, is the fact that we spend 2-3 times as much to educate rich kids than poor kids. And so what if school were more aligned with the real world challenges of life? I mean, wouldn't that be better preparation for all kids? And what if in doing so, the at-risk kids in poverty actually start to close or even reverse that gap in accomplishment, not achievement on low-level measures tied to standardized tests, which, by the way, over and over you see, that's far more a reflection of how dedicated and committed the parents are to their kids' success than the intrinsic talent and motivation of the child.
What I'd like to do is let's go from there. Let's go ahead and transition into what schools could be. And what I'd like to do, because what you're talking about, what you're kind of getting around, is doing things differently. And at the beginning of what schools could be, the very beginning of the book, you have a few words from John Dewey. If we teach today's students as we taught yesterday's, we rob them of tomorrow. Why did you start there?
Well, it's a recurring theme. We actually opened the film Most Likely to Succeed with the same quote. And, you know, and I just thought it was so appropriate for what the book was about. But I added here a second quote. I'd have to go back and look at it, but it was from Abraham Lincoln. And it's, today's democracy is built on the foundation of yesterday's education. And I feel those two things go together. I think that we seldom, you know, connect the dots between what's going on among adults in our democracy today and what took place with children in schools, you know, two decades ago. Yet, you know, you look at the reality of today, and most kids go through a school process that neither prepares them for career or citizenship. We tell them year in and year out, do things that you don't care about, but that somebody tells you you have to do so you can meet the needs of some standardized test or please some anonymous college admissions officer. We paper over it with a graduation speech that says, go out and make the world better. And we wonder why so many young adults are adrift, you know, why so many adults are angry in our country, why so many people who counted on education to give them a better life and open up doors for their kids feel like somehow they've been screwed over. And I think the honest truth is, in our quest for numbers and data, that's exactly what we're doing to millions and millions of people in our country.
Which is sad. I mean, there's so many things that have happened where I just to add my two cents, I think that you know, part of it's trying to tell people what they should want to do. whereas I see school is really about that experiencing and trying to help kids get an idea of what they might like to try and look at down the road or something like this and might have thoughts about, instead of that everybody's got to do the same thing.
And you see this play out. You know, one thing I observed was that, you know, the rich schools are college obsessed. You know, the question is never with their students, do you want to go to college or why do you want to go to college? The question is, which colleges are you thinking about? You know, what's your short list? You know, what are they looking for? How do you craft an essay that's going to appeal to admissions officers? Did you take enough honors courses? That's the life in the rich schools. The poor schools, for reasons that are totally understandable, want to be like the rich schools. And so one thing that blew me away is I went to a lot of, you know, I mean, the thing about my trip is it was all self-funded. So I wasn't going to where the fees were. I was going to where the students are. You know, so I was in urban, I was in rural, I was in tribal villages, I was in cross-section of American education. In those poor schools, you can't find a square inch of hallway space that's not covered with a college pennant or a banner that basically says, in their own way, college or bust. You know, if you don't go to college, you're not a success. And some of these schools will hold up things like, we got, every kid has to get an acceptance letter to graduate or something, as though that's a major triumph. And my point is, I think if we did K through 12 right, kids, whether they're coming from a rich school or a poor school, there are an awful lot of kids that could find their way forward without more costly formal instruction. There's this irony, right? In today's environment, anybody who's motivated can learn whatever they want to learn on their own. You know, the online resources match or exceed most of what you get in, certainly in college lecture halls. Yet, what's our mantra? You know, spend middle school preparing for high school to prepare for college, to prepare for graduate school, to then go to the career placement office and try to get the highest paying job to pay off your college loans. That's not a winning approach.
Yes, that's something that is quite ingrained. I mean, it's ingrained. It was ingrained in me. So,
well, you know, but it gets back to this achievement gap, is that the rich families will, you know, in the opening scene of the film has this fourth grader in tears. And the parent, she has no talking in the parent-teacher conference, but her mom says, you know, she just doesn't find what's going on in school relevant. And the teacher responds by saying, well, you know, my daughter, she's in law school, it's really hard, you know, but you've got to do all this to get ready for college so you can get ready for graduate school. And so what happens is there's this inevitable, and you see it play out, you know, parents run into kids third, fourth, or fifth grade that start to question, why the heck am I doing this? And so the rich, well-educated parents are on them and just say, basically over and over and over again, you've got to do this to get into the right college, because if you don't get into the right college, you won't have a great life. Boom, boom, boom. And they'll double down with an iPhone or a BMW in high school or whatever it takes to get their kid through those hoops. You know, the problem is, even the winners in that, right? The winners are going off to college. The mental health data is deeply disturbing. And employers, when they hire these people out of our top colleges, tell me these kids are like fetch a dog biscuit kids. You know, they're coming into my office hourly saying, what do I need to do to get an A? And you know, so we're not really helping any of these kids. We're hurting them in different ways. And I think when we collectively insist on a college degree, even to get a job at Starbucks, we're basically saying to any kid in America, you know, plop down one way or another $75,000 or more to get to life's starting line.
It's an interesting sort of kind of a vicious sort of circle there going on. And it's interesting, because what I want to do is I want to step from there into your travels real quick, because the whole point, you know, what happens in what schools could be is that you make this trip in 2015, 2016, where you visit over 200 schools across the U.S. How did that idea come up? I mean, and what were some of the challenges you had in making that journey reality.
Well, I wish I could say this was part of a carefully thought out long-term plan, but you mentioned earlier the TEDx talk I gave. So July of 2015, a mutual friend connected me with this entrepreneur incubator person in Fargo, North Dakota. So he had some questions about venture capital and startups, and I said, sure, I'll talk to you. We're on the phone. I'm in my, you know, like just laying back on a sofa. And he asked me what I'm interested in. And I sort of talked to him about exactly what we're talking about now. And in the middle of a sentence, he says, oh my gosh, you know, somebody just canceled for next week's TEDx event here. Because this guy happened to be the organizer of TEDx Fargo, which is a really great event. And so Greg Tavine says to me, someone just canceled. Any chance you could be here, you know, next week and give a talk? And I had, honestly, the truth is, ordinarily I would have said absolutely not. But for the 3 years before that, on my New Year's resolution list was go to North Dakota. I'd been to all other states, but that was the one holdout, the one state I haven't been to. So I said, okay, I'll go to North Dakota. And so I had to put together a talk in a few days and think it through and cancel some things and go out there. But as I thought about going to North Dakota, I said, it's going to be really interesting to go to someplace I haven't been before. I'm really looking forward to it. And so as I mulled it, I said, well, what the heck? Why don't I just go everywhere? You know, like that might be really bold and out of the box. It might be a total waste of time, but maybe I'll take away something from it interesting. And so in my TEDx talk toward the end, I say, hey, I'm going to all 50 states this year. You know, I'm like Blanche DuBois. I'm relying on the kindness of strangers to make this productive and helpful. And, you know, interestingly, in Fargo, a bunch of people responded. 6 weeks later, I was there. We did a, you know, 450 people came to the Fargo Theater. We had a great community forum. It sort of led to my coming back here again and again. But that's how it happened. And I just said, you know, not really having any idea. It's like what happens with the entrepreneurs I backed, right? You just are willing to go into something just fraught with ambiguity, having no friggin' idea what's going to come of it. But with sort of like some confidence that, you know, we'll figure it out along the way and we'll make something positive come out of this. And so that's what that trip was. But the thing I did, I have to say, I made a million, you know, like I always make a bunch of mistakes. But the one mistake I didn't make is as I thought about doing it, and it's a long story, but my director of Most Likely to Succeed did a film called Mitt about Mitt Romney. And so he said, hey, if you're doing this trip, you might think about talking to Romney's advanced campaign planning team. They're really good at plotting out a schedule when you go to someplace new. That's all they did. And so I did that. And so every single day from, you know, 7:30 in the morning till 10:30 at night, every minute was booked with something, and they were really good at finding unusual, interesting things. And so instead of a boring trip where you're kind of going to same old schools, I was, you know, like anywhere from governors to commissioners of education to state legislators to school board members, but lots and lots and lots of schools and teachers and students and parents. And so with that, I had this great base of experiences in 9 intense months to draw on for a new book.
That's awesome. I just can't even imagine this trip, because like you said, you know, and I saw in there where you had these different meetings with so many governors as well as the different schools that you went into. And I just think that's that in itself, you kind of had to be going, wow, I've got all this information now, where am I going with it type of thing. I can imagine your brain was just filled with, here we go.
And then some.
and I got to say this, because what I think is really neat about your idea for the trip, especially the way you just described it, seems to fit really well with what you're talking about with innovation within schools and encouraging teachers to be innovative, which is the idea that we're going to, you know, it's kind of like we want to go out there. Let's go. And we're going to have some stumbles along the way. But this is what we want to try and accomplish. And let's go do it.
Yeah. And I think you see in the stories in the book of over and over again, teachers willing to kind of dive into uncharted territory. Oftentimes they have no domain expertise, but just this confidence that if nothing else, students will learn if they're motivated, which happens again and again. But also understanding that the learning from the journey is so much more important than whatever ultimate destination you arrive at. And so people who obsess about, well, we've got to work this out, we've got to refine it, we can't afford for it to go off track or it might go wrong or some of the projects students do may not be that good. you know, I think that's all the wrong way to look at it. And what I found so admirable about these teachers is just this confidence and also the willingness to stand in front of a bunch of kids, often as young as kindergarten, and say, hey, I don't know, you know, let's figure this out. And you realize the world of difference between teaching and learning. And you know, it's like, you know, when you say, I'm going to teach you this, it's a very different dynamic from I'm going to help you learn this. And I think ultimately the kids that learn and retain it, the kids that are motivated, are the kids that are figuring out a lot of this stuff and making mistakes and running into dead ends. And that process is ultimately so much more aligned with life as adults. Why would we put it on hold for 12 years, 16 years?
So right on the money. You're right. Why? Let me in the opening of the book, you note that there's some common principles that you saw that emerged. You notice that students thrived in environments where they developed, and they spell the word peak, and you call it, and it's purpose, essentials, agency, and knowledge. You call these peak principles for obvious reasons. Could you explain these principles?
Well, all of this, I mean, you know, when I even late in the trip, I wasn't even thinking about writing a book. You know, it's like this wasn't like, I want to write a book, so I'll do a trip. This was, I want to do a trip, mostly to tell people how urgent it is to change schools, but also maybe I'll learn something along the way. And then ultimately, I learned a lot along the way. And then late in the process, thankfully, I took a lot of notes as I went. I said, maybe I should write a book. And so all this stuff really came from well over a year. I probably, from when I ended the trip to when I submitted the final manuscript, was, you know, 15 months. So I had a lot of time to reflect. And it was kind of a mumble jumble, to be honest, when I got done. You know, I saw all these things and they all look so different. And I was far into a first draft of the book where it was still jumbled. And I realized nobody wants to see 9 months of jumble, right? I mean, I'm not doing my job as a, you know, aspiring, not that I would take credit for being a great, but an aspiring journalist and author, if I just present to them a 9 month sequence of things and say, you know, you figure it out. And so as I kind of looked at these things, I mean, honestly, I just was a bit compulsive and sort of looking and saying, what did they have in common? What do they have in common? What do they have in common? And a lot of it goes to the fact that when I'd ask these kids in these settings, what are you doing? They had really great reasons. You know, like I'm interested in this area, so I'm. Or I want to make something, so I'm. Or we're working as a team to do the following, so we're. They had these great reasons. And when you go to a conventional school, you know, like you go to even something that they purport to be great hands-on learning, like a lab. And you'll ask these kids, so what are you doing? They'll say, step three. And I'll say, well, what's step three? And they say, well, that's a step after step two. And you realize that's conventional school. I'm just doing whatever the next step is that's put in front of me. So that was this whole aspect of purpose. And particularly so many of these places were tying the learning in the school to projects that affected the world in big and small ways, but affected the world to the good. And you realize these kids believe in what they're doing. And the teachers believe it's important, and parents see that it's important. And so in the process, they're developing, I call it essentials, but skills that matter in the 21st century and mindsets that matter in the 21st century. You know, people have written about it. You know, my co-author on my last book has done great work on that, Tony Wagner. But, you know, critical thinking, creative problem solving, communication, collaboration. But these schools and these classrooms were, in some ways, taking it one step further. They were letting the students and the teachers embrace their own definition of what they thought was important. And they were fostering mindsets around staring down failure or just powering through again and again till you get a result. And so that was really important. Then the whole agency piece, which is the irony is we give kindergarten kids a fair amount of agency and they learn at warp speed. By the time kid gets to high school, most of their daily life is prescribed by 8 a.m. Monday morning. They know what they're doing for the entire next week, maybe even the entire rest of the semester. You know, blocks of this and then blocks of this and then blocks of this with extracurricular activities, often chosen to look good on a college application. When they get into the workforce, I love the quote from this senior guy at Apple, we've decided that any employee that needs a boss is no longer employable. You know, in adult life, you want people that can manage their own time and resources and efforts. And then the knowledge, which is the whole myth. People will say, yeah, well, in conventional schools, we don't really have time for purpose and essential skills and agency. Those aren't, we'd like to, but we really need kids to buckle down and master the fundamentals. Because if they don't know this fundamental content, they can't do these other things. Talk to the kids and you say, what'd you learn last week? I don't remember. What courses did you take last semester? I don't remember. What course are you taking now? I don't know. You know, it's like over and over. And we have this myth of these kids are actually learning it, but it's just held for such a short basis of time. And in the movie, we highlight Lawrenceville Academy, where, you know, it's exclusive, really, you know, admired private school in Princeton, New Jersey. You know, one of the committee of 10 members was from Lawrenceville. They did something really smart. They gave kids the final exam they took in June. They had them retake it in September, stripping out of it all low-level questions, just the essential concepts that the faculty was convinced every kid had mastered. You know, average grade went from a B plus to an F over 2 years and lots of courses. No kid retained all of these concepts that they thought every kid was retaining. So are they really learning, or are they just cramming it into short-term memory and figuring out how to master or replicate low-level procedures and just saying it back? I think in most schools it's the latter. And that's a particularly useless skill in a world where you can get any fact you want on your phone through Google.
Yeah, you're so right, because that is something that really does happen. I mean, they just basically regurgitate it back, and somebody goes, yay!
and to your line of work, I mean, so you're asking me great questions. I will observe these schools trying to find when kids are actually encouraged to come up with thoughtful, interesting questions about what they're studying. Hardly ever. The only question you typically hear from high school kids is, will this be on the test? and you realize how easy would it be to just set aside some time each week and ask kids alone and then in groups, come up with as many interesting questions about what we're studying that you'd love to know more about. You know, if their answer is, I don't have any other than will it be on the test, spend more time. Because employers over and over again tell me, I'd much rather hire somebody who asks great questions than somebody that can give me formulaic answers I can find myself with a quick Google search. So if that's what we value as adults, what is important for citizenship and career, let's mirror that in our schools. You know, but, and this is the key point, but thoughtful questions, generating those thoughtful questions is a creative exercise. You can't do a great standardized test saying, here's a reading passage, now come up with as many thoughtful questions as you can about it. But you can do a great standardized, cheap, bulk standardized test around infer the author's tone, or why is it divided into two stanzas instead of one, or all this other that honestly never comes up in adult life, but just makes life easy for the people in New York City and Princeton, New Jersey who design these tests. And my point is, should we be organizing education for our kids around what's easy to test or what's important to learn? And honestly, education in America today is largely about what's easy to test.
And it's so unfortunate, because you're so right. And I, you know, that's one of the things that I don't understand why the political world has really kind of adopted this idea right here, which you're talking about. And I kind of want to skip forward to something that, you know, in chapter 7, you state this, and I want to come back to some other stuff in just a minute, but this is a great segue right here. You say in chapter 7, is the purpose of school to develop human potential or to rank it? And I just think that is such a, you know, that is such a wow sort of thing, because that's where we are right now, is that it seems like it's really just about ranking.
Yeah, and unfortunately, you know, in most places, and as I said in the book, I highlight what school could be versus what school is for most kids in America. But for most kids in America, it's all about ranking their performance on low-level measures tied to standardized tests. You know, how many polynomials can you factor quickly, or do these toy math exercises that your smartphone does perfectly instantly? Can you do close to 45 of them right in 37 minutes? You know, and if you can, you get a great score. And if you can't, you know, and, you know, but ironically, right, you know, any SAT test tutor will tell you, if you can't figure it out, skip it. Don't waste 5 or 10 minutes trying to figure out something you don't instantly know. What a great message for kids. If it's a hard, challenging, interesting problem, don't try to figure it out. And so we're ranking these kids on this set of really narrow proficiencies that in today's world are largely useless. You know, if I want to factor a polynomial, which by the way, I've got a great science, you know, and math background, no adult ever has to factor a polynomial in their real life. Engineers don't do it. You know, I mean, that's the irony, right? It's all in there because it's perfect fodder for standardized tests and not because scientists and engineers do it. But if you want to do it for some bizarre reason, just put photo math over the equation and it spells out the steps and gives you the answer. You know, so why would that still be the heart and soul of the way we measure kids and measure schools? Well, it's the heart and soul because it's really easy to test and it lets you play around with a mix of questions and get this bell curve of results. And I say, like, whoa, isn't that a wake-up call? That education is all about ranking kids because some bureaucrats or college admissions officers like nice, convenient measures to let them stack order kids instead of letting them develop their potential, which ultimately leads to a whole myriad of diverse paths forward. Letting kids get really good at things that are harder to measure, letting them develop real proficiency that will matter in the world of innovation. And there is, and underscore this five times and put it in 72-point font, acute urgency in understanding this and changing schools. Because if you trust education, if you put in 12 to 16 years and you leave school largely prepared to fail, you know, what happens? You know, what happens? And I think that's the issue we should all be really dwelling on, focusing on, and doing whatever we can to change it.
Just, I love your thoughts here. This is because I'm gonna push forward to, because this just lends itself right into. And before I do this, I do have to say, I love the way the book is laid out, because you, in each chapter, you have an overriding kind of theme or thought, and then you introduce what your thoughts are, and then we start. You go to these different schools wherever they are, or these teachers wherever they are, and you let them. You share what they do. And it lets you kind of put your brain starts just, or at least my brain starts just going boom, it's on fire, and it's just thinking all over the place, you know, focusing on what I'm hearing the teacher share and what you're bringing forward, and I love that. In chapter 8, I love this because kind of where you left off with what you were just talking about, you get into this, you have this title, doing obsolete things better. And in the opening of the section, you paint a picture of the conventional school being a covered wagon, and the do things better leaders seek operational efficiency. Could you talk a little more about this and share what you found?
Yeah, you know, and what I found is, you know, we typically think schools that produce high test scores are the successful schools, and schools that have lousy test scores are the failing schools. And what we really need to do in American education is get the failing schools to be more like the successful schools. That is, ultimately, in a sentence, U.S. education policy for 30 years. And when you realize that they're all doing things that are obsolete, that are going to actually impair their prospects going forward, that's where I had this idea of comparing it to covered wagons. And our policies have basically said, gee, our covered wagons are just going too slow, and we've got, you know, faster and slower covered wagons. We kind of know it's not right, but, you know, like, let's just get the slower covered wagons to be more like the fast covered wagons and all will be well. How do you get the slow covered wagons to speed up? Well, we'll measure them more frequently. We'll rely on big data. We'll beat the mules harder. We'll grouse about how the adults around the covered wagon are organized. We'll think, oh my gosh, if we could just have more charter covered wagons, you know, with relentless beating of the mules, they go 0.3 miles an hour faster. Isn't that a great model? So let's channel millions and millions, maybe billions of dollars into getting more slightly faster covered wagons, and all will be well. And you realize, I didn't meet a single person as I traveled that I would say had anything other than really great intentions. But I did sort of draw a conclusion, right, that if you look at what's required to rise to the top of the education pyramid, by and large, those people were all impeccably well-educated and very skilled at dealing with and managing bureaucracies. That's how you get to the top of a great big organization. And so they naturally gravitate to policies and procedures that made them successful. So we will manage our education system through data. We will prescribe, you know, the you know, common core set of college-ready standards every kid has to master. We will put our priority on making sure every kid studies the same thing so we can measure them more precisely. And I would say measure their ability to memorize and forget the same irrelevant material, but get it down to two decimal points. Isn't that a major advance in education? And I really believe that that explains what we've done to our schools and to our teachers over and over again for 30 years. And what I found to be the shock, right, is that the teachers know that. The teachers are like the troops on the ground in a war we'll never win. And they don't believe in the mission, and they entered, you know, they joined the teaching army with the best of all intentions. They desperately want to engage and inspire kids and help them find their own path forward. But they're dealing with a mission they reject, they're skeptical about for great reasons. I mean, I came away with the greatest amount of empathy for our teachers. You know, you think about taking some boring topic that when a student asks you, when am I ever going to use this? And your honest answer is you never will. Students don't care about it. You've got 30, 35 of them in a class, and you're trying to deliver a mesmerizing lecture on factoring polynomials, knowing they don't care about it, they'll never use it, and somehow you got to bring it to life. And some bureaucrat somewhere has watched the movie Stand and Deliver and said, well, this one guy in South Central LA made calculus interesting. Why aren't you? And now you got to do that 5 times a day, 5 days a week. And these kids are used to smartphones and great video graphics and amazing movies. And how the heck can anybody bring that to life for these kids? I don't know. I mean, like, the fact that those teachers go in there day after day and give it their best, I just say, like, that is nothing short of a miracle. And then you look at these different settings, you know, the what school could be settings, where the teachers are trusted and they're really coaching and advising and inspiring their students, and the students have a voice in what they're doing, and they can't wait to get to school because they know it's important and they think it's really interesting, and they are just sort of not competing against each other but working together to make a positive impact on their world. You know, like, whoa, what a difference. And yet if we value schools by test scores and college placements, and if college admissions doesn't change, which is a topic of the book, teachers are swimming upstream and trying to take on that broader, more inspiring and aspirational vision.
That is so right on the money. I think about it because I was a history teacher for 9 years. And so you want to talk about a course that the kids come in prepared to say, all right, so, you know, make me even a little bit interested in the past.
And, you know, and imagine, right? I often say to people involved in education, imagine if we asked teachers to do the following. Take a kid at the start of your course, and your goal is to make them far more interested in it by the end of the course. Not to cover this checkbox of content, not to do the nonsense of AP US history, you know, go from 1491 to the present day of US history and spend 2 days on the Vietnam War and 2 days on World War II, and, you know, like, not to do that. What we really want you to do above everything else is to have kids that come into your class and leave that class far more interested in history. And how you get there and how you do that, it's up to you, but we're counting on you to get your kids so fired up about history that they just love it for the rest of their life. You know, imagine that. Would you as a teacher be like all over that? You would.
Oh yeah.
Would these kids ultimately soak up so much more history in adjacent areas? They absolutely would. History is fascinating, but I'll tell you, even our top performing students who have finished and gotten a 5 on AP History, World or US, when I ask them, what'd you learn in your history class? You know what they tell me? I learned I never want to take another history class. They'll tell me, I don't want to go to a college. It requires me to take a history course. Say, like, what a Pyrrhic victory that is.
Right.
You know, like, what are we doing?
It's sad because that is, because I love that challenge. I mean, that's why I became a teacher, was to make history fun, because it was something that somebody wants to know more about and so forth. And I have my father to blame because he used to stop and he had all this interest. He'd stop at the roadside and read some little insignificant sign that, and now I do that to my family, which I think is funny. but it's one of those challenges that you see in any subject whatsoever, any content area. I love it when you run into the teachers who they see that as their mission is to figure out how to make you want to do more, want to know more, want to be part of this content area more. You know, you come in saying, oh, I don't want to do biology, or what I want to do this or whatever. And, you know, you leave going, woohoo, this is like, I like this. This is cool, you know. And that the standardized, the focus on so much information, you know, kind of that image of a fire hydrant, you know, wide open, blowing you out, like you just described just a second ago, that doesn't lend itself to the thoughts of, I want to do this again. It lends itself to that other, which is, I never want to take another history course again, which is not fun. So tell me, in the book, in the stories that the teachers relayed to you, is there any favorite one that just stands out, that's one of just really one you'd really like to share with us?
Well, I mean, so many, and I drew from hundreds, maybe thousands of these things to pick, you know, generally, and I chose this organization, and I hope people appreciate it and like it, but you never know, but, you know, of generally picking something in each state to basically reinforce the point that these great examples are kind of both everywhere and nowhere. Because I think too often people think, well, we can't do it here. Maybe they can do it, you know, somewhere else. But actually, I found some of the most innovative, you know, examples in states that people would not think are particularly innovative. So, you know, I lead off my chapter on K through 12 with this guy. I love this guy, Jared Nipper, who, you know, you and I talk about. He's 10 years on the police force, decided to go into teaching, gets his credential, finally gets his responsible for his kindergarten class, says to his principal, you know, before school starts, hey, I've got this thing I want to do with my kids. You know, I want to let them design robots and do 3D printing. And the principal says, well, Jared, you know, like, how much do you know about this? And he says, absolutely nothing. And he says, well, Jared, do you have any of the equipment? He says, we have none, no equipment. But, and this is key, the principal had his back. He said, well, if you really believe in this, I'll support you. I'm sure people will complain, but I'll support you. And so Jared takes kindergarten kids out in the Fort Wayne, Indiana community, raises the money for the equipment, stands in front of his kids and says, here's what we get to do. I don't know how to do it. We're going to figure it out as we go. And, you know, he's worried. Everybody's worried. Will they fall behind in basic reading and math skills? But he points out that the state legislature specifies that you've got to spend 90-minute uninterrupted blocks of reading time. And he says, have any of these people spent time with five-year-olds? Whew, what five-year-old wants to read nonstop for 90 straight minutes? I mean, maybe a few, but most don't. And, you know, his kids do really well in math and reading, but they're so energized, and it spreads to other classrooms. And now Jared, this postdates the book, is principal of his own elementary school.
Nice.
You know, and so you see this, and it's just a guy who says, I don't think what they're telling me to do makes sense. And I think if I just give them, and not that it has to be robots or 3D printing, it could be anything. But if I do things my kids can't wait to get to school to do, I have a feeling they're going to learn a lot. And if we stop obsessing about exactly what they learn a lot of and let them just soak it up, these kids will rise to the occasion. And they did. You know, it's like they did. And was every project perfect? No. There's a whole mix of projects. But I'll tell you, it just is such better preparation for life. And, you know, so and I feel the same amount of affection for everybody I write about, because, boy, I'll tell you, it's easy for me. I mean, like, I hope the credit, if people read the book and like it, I hope they give the credit to the teachers. I'm really just sharing their stories. But they are doing the most remarkable things. And when you see them in aggregate, you realize, boy, if this is what school looked like, these kids, despite the overhang, the looming threat of machine intelligence wiping out all the routine jobs, which I worry about a lot, despite all those advances, these kids are going to be off and running and make their world better and go through life, you know, being able to support themselves with a real sense of purpose and retaining their curiosity and developing intellectual interest. We could do that. And what would we give up? We would give up the ability to precisely rank order kids on material they're studying and not retaining, and that as adults they'll never use. And I say that seems like a pretty good trade-off to me.
Oh, that's an excellent trade-off. I love the book. And, you know, in conjunction with what you just said, I want to, before we finish, I want to get you to comment this, because you, at the end of what school could be, you say, in education, our experts know what to do. The problem is we listen to the wrong experts. Can you just kind of add a little bit more to that, entice them to want to read this chapter?
Well, you know, you think about it, right? Who do we listen to? I don't want to pick on any given person, but we'll listen to philanthropists that dropped out of college who say that the most important thing is that every kid in K through 12 is prepared for college, even if it means they lose their inventiveness and creativeness and ability to do bold things. You know, we listen to bureaucrats at the top of the Department of Education who, it doesn't matter whether it's Republican or Democrat, they have so let down kids all across the country. Somehow we think those are the people we should listen to. And what I believe and what I'm trying to do in the book is show if we actually took the time to listen to teachers, we might learn remarkable things about what school could be.
Before we close out, because I have a couple other questions I want to ask you, but if a listener would like to reach out to you, Ted, and learn more, what would be the best way? And tell us where they could get a copy of What School Could Be.
Yeah, so you can pre-order it now on the usual suspects, Amazon and Barnes & Noble. I love independent bookstores, so we're hoping to get a bunch there. They can reach me. I'm on Twitter at @DinterSmith. My email, I'll tell you it, but I have to apologize in advance. So it's just first initial, last name, tdintersmith@gmail.com. I don't even get to emails from my wife anymore. It's just like I've got a lot of emails coming in, and I really feel terrible when people reach out to me and I can't immediately get back to them. But I do my best. And you know, the thing I'm particularly interested in, you know, I occasionally, you know, I've got a speakers bureau and they'll occasionally set me up with something that'll pay me a fee, which I then just put back in a nonprofit. But on my own, I'll do anything for free, but I really gravitate toward people who have a game plan for something that could scale and have impact, not on a school or a few kids. But to me, the challenge in our country is not to help a school here and there, but to help all schools. You know, like if we don't make things better for millions and millions of kids, it's not enough to just have a few winners and lots of losers. And so anybody that approaches me that says, if you'll do this, we can really, you'll help us be able to accomplish something big and bold, I'm likely to be on a plane to help them if I can do it.
That's awesome. And you need to take them up on it, guys. So what I'd like to do is finish with a couple of questions here that I like to ask guests. And the first one is, if you were given the chance to talk with 100 brand new teachers and they haven't started teaching yet, all right, what advice would you give them?
Well, you know, the magic of being a teacher, and I've got a daughter who's 19, and that's something she's thinking hard about. And I tell her over, you know, it's so interesting. I'll often ask adults, you know, to think back about, you know, when they were growing up, what really made the difference to the person they became. And you can't find an adult, I at least haven't been able to find an adult, who won't point to one or several teachers that just really made the difference for them. And so when you're a teacher, you're changing not just a life here and there, you've got the opportunity to change so many lives. And then when those lives change, they in turn change other lives. And so that presence, that teacher that believes in a kid, that teacher that gets a kid confident and believing they can accomplish things, the kid that gets really interested in a field, that's pure magic. And so I would say to any, if I were in front of 100 teachers, I'd say, I can't think of anything more important than what you're about to do. And just keep in mind that, you know, that even though you're going to get pushback from here, there, and everywhere about doing the types of things that you are entering the field to do, stay the course. Your main goal in life is to engage and inspire your kids and help them find their own potential and make full advantage of the opportunities that they can create for themselves. And, you know, I believe it. You know, I think it's the most noble of professions. And I often observe, how the heck can we live in a country that trusts teachers to take a bullet for our students, but feels we have to micromanage them in the classroom with their lesson plans? I mean, something is really off with that disconnect.
So what advice, let's look at the administrative side of it. What advice would you give principals about helping their schools and teachers become more focused on innovation and engagement?
Well, there's a lot of influence a principal and ultimately a superintendent and a school board can have. And what I find is there's an enormous amount of pent up innovation in our teaching staff. I mean, there are, not every teacher, I don't want to, you know, overstate things. I'm definitely not saying that there aren't good, bad, and indifferent teachers, just like, you know, there are good, bad, and indifferent venture capitalists and good, bad, and indifferent entrepreneurs. I mean, every field of life has good, bad, and indifferent. But there are a lot of teachers just itching to do things that are far better for their students. And that's a common denominator when you look across all these stories. And I try to highlight that is that in essentially every case, somebody else had their back. You know, a teacher wanted to do something like Jared I talked about earlier. The principal said, I've got your back. A principal wants to do something. Superintendent says, I've got your back. Superintendent wants to do something and the state commissioner says, I've got your back, because change is hard and everybody locks in on the vision of school they had when they went to school. So when you start doing something different, complainers will come out on that. And so if somebody is standing tall behind you, supporting you, I think consistently delivering a message that not only is change urgent, but the possibility, if we do this, is to launch a whole generation of kids that are so much better prepared for their futures than what we're doing now, I think that you're going to see a lot. And, you know, and I do feel the pain of our public schools. We have tied them up in knots with No Child Left Behind for 20 years, 25 years, and then we say, oh, but our public schools aren't innovating. You know, it's like really, let's just tie, you know, 50-pound weights around the foot of somebody, of each of their two legs, and they say, well, they're not turning in very good times in their road races. Well, you know, like, let's take those darn weights off and give them a chance to run. You know, like, it just seems to me like that's what we owe them.
That's incredible right there. Thank you so much. So I want to ask you this last question, and you actually gave me a great segue into this a few minutes ago. Do you have a teacher in your past who made a difference in your life? And if given a chance to say thank you, who would it be and what would you say?
Well, you know, I in the book I wrote with Tony, I talk about my high school Spanish teacher, you know, a guy named James Canavan. If somebody listening to this knows him, he was from Philadelphia, went to LaSalle. I've done every online search I can do to try to find him, and so far, no good. But, you know, and it's funny, I often go after foreign languages as an example of, by and large, an enormous waste of time in our schools. Because the average kid does 2 years of seat time, memorizes some words, does some conjugations, can't wait to get done with it, leaves. And if they're taking Spanish, if I ask them como se llama, they have no idea what I just asked them. So yeah, I think there's a lot of room for improvement in foreign language instruction. Yet, my favorite teacher was a Spanish teacher. And why? We would come into that room and his only ground rule was, when you step across the threshold, no English can be spoken. And we would have the most fun, interesting conversations in Spanish about what's going on in the school, what's going on in the world, current events, past history, funny stories. And then at the end, he'd mention in Spanish, this was a fun and interesting conversation. We can make it even more fun tomorrow. If any of you get a chance to pick up some more vocabulary words at home or practice some verb conjugations and go with it. So he wasn't saying which verbs, which, you know, vocabulary words. And we would all go home and try to get better vocabularies. We'd all go home and practice our conjugations. By the end of that class, I was thinking in Spanish. Nice. It was fun. It was engaging. You know, it was like, to this day, I can go to a foreign country and speak some Spanish. And you just realize, what if, it's what I said before, what if our first priority in the classes is to make kids more interested in it and let the learning follow behind that? And so that to me was, you know, my most transformational K-12 teacher on a topic that I think is largely a missed opportunity in schools today.
That, oh my gosh, that is so powerful right there. And I love what, you know, just that thought about, first of all, he made it engaging and made you want to know more and to be able to do more. And then just your statement about the idea that if that's what we wanted to do, we set out about wanting to make it more interesting. And, you know, if that's our first priority. Wow. And I love it. Ted, thank you so much for sharing with us today. I thoroughly enjoyed hearing about your lessons learned from your travels. And additionally, what's, you know, just everything about what school could be, insights and inspiration from teachers across America. You know, it's inspiring thought-provoking. I mean, just, and you got me really thinking. I want to go back in the classroom, man.
We need you there. We need you. You seem like you'd be changing kids' lives day in and day out. So,
well, I appreciate that. I wish you the best at all you do, and I will put links to the different places to find, from the websites to your books and the movie, and as well as Twitter and your email, and I hope that we get a chance to talk again down the road.
Excellent. Thanks. I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much, Ted.
Take care.
Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is excited to be a member of Voice Ed Radio. Voice Ed Radio, your voice is right here. The opinions expressed on Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 are those of the guests and host. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is intended to share ideas, advice, and suggestions for classroom teachers and school administrators. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is produced for educational purposes. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll share it with your friends.